Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 79 of Game On with Cody and John.
Both of the other ships have been destroyed.
Two down, one to go.
Data report.
The anomaly has nearly collapsed.
We're losing containment.
Goodbye, Jean-Luc. I'm going to miss you. You had such potential. But then again, all good things must come to an end.
Containment field isn't critical. I'm losing it.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer. Bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming. Board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming. News and discussions on gaming and gamer culture. Plus, reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers. It is Game On with Cody and John for a few games more. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. It's been another great few weeks of gaming here in the gaming capital of the world. How's it going, Cody?
It's going all right. We are in the midst of the final five. We're in
Final five episodes of Game On with Cody and John.
These are
valuable episodes.
Well,
you're definitely getting what you're paying for.
Exactly.
These episodes.
That's right. Prizes and participation may vary, of course.
That's right.
But speaking of podcasts, we have a big shoe for you today.
That's right. We're going to talk to you a little bit about podcasting. You know, as we're wrapping up our show here at Game On with Cody and John, we just wanted to talk to you a little bit about how we got involved in podcasting, what it takes to make a good podcast, or, you know, what it took to make our podcast. And, you know, maybe also give you some recommendations for podcasts that we appreciate and respect that you might want to check out as Game On fades into the sunset.
That's right. And I can't really do a segue from sunset, but... The new hotness out there.
The sunset involves the sun, which also can experience an
eclipse.
That's right.
That was better than nothing, I guess. We're going to be talking about the new hotness. And since you really can't get it, except for overpaying, this is a great time to really chew the fat on it and really decide if it's the game for you. And we're going to help you by giving you the Game On review.
That's right. But hey, we're going to start off with a rundown as always. You ready?
Do it.
Well, it's once again time for the rundown where we talk about all the games and geekery we've participated in the last few weeks. But first, we would be remiss if we did not, as always, pay due penance to our great sponsor, Myriad Games. Myriad Games sponsors Game On with Cody and John on behalf of friendly professional
game stores everywhere.
And Cody, tell us what's going on with Myriad.
Well, you can help out. Yeah, I'm so sorry. You can help out Myriad because they are trying to be the best game, voted best game store of 2011. So if you go to myriadgames.com/vote, you can help them along. And if you've ever had any service from them, I think you would agree that they are the best in the biz.
How does that work? Is it just you go to the page and it's like, what's the best game store? A, Myriad Games. There you go. That's the whole question.
It's run by about.com.
Oh, okay.
So they're just taking nominations. So go to myriadgames.com/vote today. Don't walk, like a run down. That was a segue in the biz.
Great.
John.
What was that I heard one time when they say that, if, you know, when radio guys that have great segues... or have good segues are the ones that have to mention them. The ones that have great segues don't have to mention that they're segues.
Exactly.
Okay. Having said that,
though, I think we're going to do probably a combo rundown a little bit, at least for
a good portion of it.
A good portion of it.
Because we had a big event this past weekend.
Huge.
And that was the fine birthday festivities for Chancellor Cody L. Jones.
Thank you.
Yeah, no.
I got older. So.
That's right. You are now a hale and hearty 29. Is that right?
Foot in the grave.
That's My goodness. And so we got together for some gaming here at the Jones Estate, also the Game On Studios.
Yes.
And what did we play?
We started off with how many did we start with? Six, seven.
We started with six, and then we added one more.
That's right.
Greg showed up.
Right, so we started with a game of Telestrations. I'd recently gotten the I would call it the deluxe edition of it, because really you can just play with a pencil and paper. Everyone seemed kind of about when I suggested it, but it was my birthday, so they couldn't complain.
That's right. We play what you want to play.
That's right. We didn't do any of the scoring because, I mean, come on, it's about the experience.
Yeah, the scoring was, I mean, they just threw it in there to be silly,
Yeah.
So it's actually a game and not just an activity, but yeah, don't play with the scoring if you buy this game. It's not worth it.
But I have to say the deluxe edition, as I'm going to call it, or the only edition of it, it's pretty nice. Like the little dry erase pads, and it comes with a ton of markers and cards and stuff. It's pretty nice for what you, I mean, at the end of the day, it's just, telestrations or eat poop you cat or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I mean, for those of you, it's pretty popular right now, but if you've never heard of this game, it's more or less telephone but written down. So, everybody will get a board. It's like a little flip board with different dry erase things, and you'll have a card with some clues on it or different words or phrases. You'll write that phrase down, and then you'll pass your little board to the next person who will look at that word, flip the page, and then draw that word or phrase. And then that'll pass to the next person, who the only thing they'll look at is that picture, and then they have to write what they see. So it goes back and forth between writing and drawing until you get to get the book back around to you, and then you pretty much just kind of share the progression of things, and everybody laughs and thinks that it's funny.
Yeah, I think our best one was the word was birthday suit.
Yeah.
And it ended up being shoulder cake.
Shoulder cake. And that was my fault, because I was trying to draw like birthday stuff, like a cake and presents. And then I was trying to draw a guy in a suit. But I ran out of time, because you do use like a sand timer to time your drawing. And so the best I could get out was sort of the outline of a guy. And then I was pointing to what was supposed to be his suit, but it was pointing to his shoulder. So it became shoulder cake.
So enjoy a great piece of shoulder cake with your next gaming event.
Your cake, by the way, Batgirl, very nice.
That's right.
Done by your lovely wife.
Mrs. Jones bringing out the Batgirl homemade cake, and it was Batrific.
Is that purple frosting on it?
Yes, purple and gold, baby.
Impressive, yeah.
It was well done.
What did we play after that?
We played, I believe, our good friend Dave had a game called Get Bit, which reminded me a lot of Guillotine. It was slightly different, but the cool thing was the idea was it's like you're trying to get away from, like, you're on the water and there's a shark that's eating pieces of people, and you're trying to basically get in the front of the line so that you're not the one that gets a leg bitten off by the shark. And it comes with
get away from the front of the line, right?
Yeah, you want to get away from where the shark is.
Right.
I guess I assume the shark's in the back, and you're trying to get to the.
Right. Okay.
But however you want to word it, the cool
away from the shark. Yeah,
away from the shark. The cool thing is, it comes with these little plastic dudes that have detachable feet and legs and torsos and heads, and it's like a step up from Lego, but that's kind of a neat little thing they threw in there.
Little plastic dudes. That's pretty cool. Yeah. And a plastic. I think Dave had the deluxe edition or something like that that comes with the plastic shark
expansion.
The shark expansion, right? Yeah. That has an actual plastic shark too.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
Yeah. What else? What did we play after that?
Then we kept along sort of the lighter party game line and played the best party game.
Yes.
Of all time, and that is Time's Up Title Recall.
That's right.
And by that time, I think we had 8 players.
Yeah,
we had 4 couples. Four pairs.
Yeah, that was a good one. That's where, what was the one everyone made fun of me about? It was the Jungle Book, but I thought...
Oh, the difference between Mowgli from the Jungle Book and Mogwai from Gremlins.
Yeah, because my partner, the clue was the Jungle Book, and he said Mowgli.
Uh-huh.
And I've never seen the Jungle Book. I don't know. He always said Gremlins.
Gremlins. And that's Mogwai.
And then I'm like, oh, yeah, Jungle Book. But
the great thing about that game, when someone makes a error like that or just a funny thing like that, is that it gets propagated around the entire time.
Oh, yes.
And so even gestures that are incorrect or something like that, as long as it makes you remember the actual clue, then you can go for it. So that I think that's a lot of fun.
That's what makes it fun, because in along the same way where it's like wits and wagers, you don't have to necessarily be good at trivia to be good at that. Time's Up can get that way too. It's like if you just have a good memory and you can really just play off what people remember, you don't have to necessarily be that good at pop culture
right.
to really get it. So that one's always fun. Another game that we had.
Well, I was the winner, by the way. Caitlin's sister, Kathy.
Yeah, whatever.
Yep. You did great.
It was all about second place. me and Morgan.
Sure. Okay.
Bringing the funk.
Isn't it like, you know, when the birthday boy, when there's like, you know, prizes and stuff, the birthday boy doesn't get a prize because.
Yeah.
So you weren't allowed to win any games, right?
Yeah, I guess that was true.
Oh, I'm sorry. But you got cake.
Yeah. One game I definitely didn't win was, and we had multiple games of this going throughout the day, was my buddy Dare brought over. He has a carom board.
Oh, yeah.
It's real nice. It was a big deal that he brought it, and, you know, he had the special powder. You know, he joked that he brought some cocaine.
Looks like a big bag of cocaine he brought. It's fantastic. Yeah. Like, what kind of party is this?
But I love dexterity games and games like Crokinole and Carom. So a lot of people had never seen it, let alone played it. So it was kind of cool to get that going. I think the next big thing that most of us played was Battlestar Galactica.
Right.
We decided to play a vanilla. I'm trying to give that one. I like that game. I want to see if it's worth owning again. Kind of, you know, Jones theory there. So we played a vanilla game of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a five player, right? No sympathizer. So
that's right. Yeah.
It was a fiver. And despite me being completely stupid, because I was a Cylon, because I'm always a Cylon, I hold back on sabotaging skill checks. Like, I'll only do it one every three or four, because that's a real easy way to get found out, as I discovered. So for one challenge, I threw in one bad card. Because I'm like, oh, the other people throwing in Destiny, they'll mask it enough for me. But the exact way it went down with what came out from Destiny and the other players, it basically made it to where logic made it that I had to be a Cylon. And so my first game turn that I had, I had to reveal.
Right.
I could not keep up the charade, so I had to be a revealed Cylon. And it was awful.
Well, it was funny because I think I had gotten up to use the restroom or something, and I came back, and they were showing me the skill card, just so I, you know, we want to make sure you knew what was going on here, John. We got this going on. And there was just sort of this quiet, no one was saying anything, and we kind of went on with the next turn, and I stopped and I said, no, wait a minute. This means that Cody's definitely a Cylon. There's really no other way around that.
I was hoping
that, right?
It was just going to pass. I'm like, oh no.
And Cody was trying his best to kind of deadpan it and like, But you know,
there's no way to defend against it.
Yeah. And that's okay. I thought it was actually kind of fun to have a game where the Cylon had to reveal early like that, because that changes the dynamic of the game quite a bit.
Yeah. I enjoy that game. My one complaint is still that I think it goes on about 20 minutes too long. It's kind of once the last Cylon is revealed, that should be the climax of the game, and then it should be 5, maybe 10 minutes after that. And then now it's like the last Cylon reveals, and you're just fighting for 20 minutes, and it's
back and forth.
Yeah.
And yeah, hoping you get the right crisis cards so that you don't die and that kind of thing. Yeah.
There's been this print and play that's been really popular in BGG called BSG Express.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's a print and play, but you can order a printed version from the print and play productions guy. And it's basically the essence of BSG distilled down to about an hour. And instead of cards, there are dice. So you might have dice that are, you know, people have strong dice and weak dice that give you pluses or minuses to a check. And even the strong dice have a few like -2, -3 on it. And so, you know, whenever there's a crisis check in this one, everyone rolls their dice in secret, and one at a time they pledge dice.
Hmm.
And so even if you have, even you could not be a Cylon and you just rolled crap on your die and you have to place one, you know, people be like, oh, why did you place that -3? Or if you decide not to place one, they're like, oh, okay. And you're trying to say, no, I rolled crap. You don't want me to. And uh-huh. So it seems like it's got the essence of BSG in about an hour.
Oh, nice.
And it's got dice. So,
yeah.
That should be coming in soon, so in time to give a review before we go.
Oh my goodness.
Be strong. Now, while we were doing that, a few other folks were playing. So I didn't get to see everything that was going on. We had two tables going. That was kind of nice.
Yeah, in different rooms, so we couldn't really see what was going on.
I know they played Snow Tales,
mm-hmm.
and a game that I know Greg and Dave have been talking a lot about called Scrum Brawl.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot about that.
It looked like a sport-esque kind of game,
yeah.
Like in a la Blood Bowl.
It looked pretty fun.
Yeah, but the folks that were playing it, they really seemed to enjoy it.
There was a lot of hooting and hollering.
Yeah, I think Morgan said he was looking for a way to buy it, because he was sold on it.
So I'll have to try out Scrum Brawl.
Yeah.
What else? Then I think we broke for dinner.
Got some dinner. I got some Subway. It was nice.
Yep.
And then we came back, and we wanted to do – by that time, it was about 8:30, something like that, and I wasn't going to be able to stay too much later. Said to get home and kiss the kids and put them in bed, and so I've decided to, along with Cody's wife, Kaylin, and her sister, Kathy, to play like a quicker card game. And then, Cody and his group.
That's right. We men retreated to the retreated to the den and played a 5-player game of Eclipse. I'll talk about that more when we get to the Buy, Try, or Deny, because then it'll make a lot more sense. But a good time was had by most.
Yeah. And the game that I played was one that we had just gotten recently from Mayfair Games, a new card game called Rocket Jockey. Mm. The tagline on the game is Planet Hopping, Never Stopping.
I see. That rhymes.
It does. And the artwork in this game, very much evocative of sort of 50s, 60s cheesy sci-fi a la Alien Frontiers. That's the second time that I've said a la in this
I know.
In this episode. So, but you know,
what's your favorite cooking game?
Shoot, I was hoping I could think of one that wasn't a la carte, but that's going to be
it. Oh, they're going to say Walkstar.
Not Walkstar. Anyway, Cody noted that on the front here, the guy, the hero dude on the front looked an awful lot like DC comic book hero Booster Gold.
Yes.
And
friend of the show, Booster
Gold. Friend of the show, Booster Gold. And the game itself is a relatively simple card game. Simple in its execution, but as far as the thinkiness of it, I think it can be a little bit of a crispy brain burner.
You guys played that for a good bit.
It took more than an hour, and that was kind of surprising. I wasn't expecting it to take that long. But in the game, you have 9 cards, the one that represent each planet. And they say in the rule book that in the game, in the future, Pluto is regains its planet status by popular demand.
I see.
And in these games, below each of the in this game, below each of the planets is a cargo card, and it's almost like a pick up and deliver game where you're trying to pick up cards from one planet and move them to another planet, and it'll say on the card what planet it's supposed to go to. But what you have to do is you have cards in your hand that are maneuvers that will allow you to move from one planet to another. So it might say, and they're all numerical, so it'll say, you know, rocket booster, which will move you from 7 to 5 or from 5 to 7. And so what you're trying to do is to move these things around, and you want to move in as many moves as possible. If you just use one card to make a move, maybe you move from 5 to 7 and it moves that cargo that's supposed to go to 7 to the 7, then you're going to get 1 point for that. But if you're able to do it with 2 cards, like maybe you have a card that'll take you from 5 to 4 and then from 4 to 7, well, then you're going to get 3 points for that. And there's like a little chart. Hmm. It's not quite exponential, but as you do more cards, you'll get more points. So you're trying to sort of line up these combinations of things so you can move things around. There's also cards that are called co-pilot cards that sit in front of you. There's 4 of them that will allow you to either change the value that's on a card. So instead of going from 5 to 7, maybe now this card will go from 5 to 8. You can use those. Those are kind of one-time use. You can also use the co-pilot cards to reserve a cargo. Because, you know, this is all sitting out in the middle of the table. So if you're trying to plan a big move with a 4 or 5 card move, and then someone steals your cargo and moves it themselves the next turn, then you're kind of screwed. So it allows you to use a cold pilot card to reserve that for one turn so that you have some time to build up the cards that you need. But, you know, that's pretty much it. And then when the cargo deck runs out, then you're going to score based upon how many different planets you've delivered to, because you keep the cargo card after you delivered it. And then you get tons of points for delivering to as many planets as possible. The game kind of continues like that, and then it gets to an end game where you put in this sort of alien visitor card where the aliens are heading towards Earth, and they start out at like the number 10 planet, like a fake number 10 planet, and then slowly move towards Earth, and when they get to Earth, then the game is over and you do a final scoring. Hmm. It sounds real light, and you know, yeah, you're playing cards, you're moving stuff around, but really when you're trying to plan those combos out and you're just limited to the cards that are in your hand, and on your turn you can draw 2 cards, up to 2 cards, it's really tricky, and you find yourself just sort of staring at the board. Oh, can I do this? Can I do that? Can I do this? And it wasn't as social and as light as I thought it would be. It really reminded me, and I think Cody, when he looked at the game, when he kind of came in and saw what we were doing, he mentioned Perry Rodan, the Cosmic League, the 2-player Cosmos game that's a pick up and deliver game. He said, "Oh, it kind of looks like that." And it did, and that's what I sort of thought it was going to be about. But Perry Rodan, I think, is probably a little bit of a easier to grasp game and a little bit less brain burningness. So it's not exactly a hardcore Euro game, but it's a little thinkier than just like a light family card game. So I thought it was okay. I think the consensus of the three of us was that it was okay. The one big downside I'll just mention real quick is that you do have to keep track of all your scoring on a pen with pen and paper.
That's not so bad.
It's not, but I figure that, I don't know, and I don't know the retail price for this game. I'm guessing it's probably 20, I'm not even going to guess. If I had to guess, I would probably say $20, but I don't know. Is that they should have included some kind of tracker, even like a small board or some kind of a thing where you can move a pawn around, because you're constantly scoring points every single turn. And so poor Kaylin, she was our scorekeeper. She had, you know, she spent half her time doing that rather than playing the game. So so check it out if that sounds interesting to you. The sort of the pick up and deliver and the sci-fi spacey sort of a theme was kind of neat, but I've gone on for far too long. It was a little mini review, but that's a Rocket Jockey from Mayfair. So I played that one, and then that was the end of the experience for me at the Jones Estate, and I headed for home.
Very good. Other geekery?
Other geekery. Well, I did get my new copy of the second edition of War of the Ring.
Ooh.
And I've been very excited about that. It's like the first big, probably one of the first big hobby games that I bought that I just wanted to try out, with something with a big, you know, massive rule set and multiple hours to play. And I ended up trading it away several years ago, because this is before I met Cody, and I didn't really have someone that I could play with on a regular basis. And so I just wasn't getting to the table at all. So I got the new edition of this, which it's got the board has been revised, where it looks, the colors on the board are just beautiful. All the miniatures are pretty much the same, as are the cardboard tokens. The cards in this game, though, have been, the size of the cards have been increased. So they're almost like the size of Seven Wonders cards.
Oh.
And they've got a lot of text on them, and the cards do a lot of things in the game. So I really like that they're larger. And I even bought the extra thing that came with, that you could get with it, which is for $15, you can get a special tin, like with artwork on it, that has a whole set of sleeves in it, so you can keep all of your cards in the tin. Unfortunately, the tin doesn't really fit in the box, so that has to be separate. But I know, but I'm sure someone has probably done Plano boxes or something like that to make everything fit in the box, but I haven't done that yet. But I'm really looking forward to getting that one to the table. So in the next couple of weeks, I think Cody, you and I'll have to plan a Saturday afternoon or something to play that one. But
yes.
That's been about it as far as gaming.
Yeah, and if you want to really follow up with what we've been doing, we've kind of made the rounds as far as our farewell tour, as we've been calling it.
Oh, yeah.
We did guest spots on both Ludology and on the D6 generation.
Yeah.
I'm not sure episode numbers off the top of my head. I know the Ludology one is their Super Bowl special where we talked about sports games. And then the D6G one is the one where they review Savage Worlds. And,
yeah, that's going to be, I think that's episode 97 of the D6 generation.
So check those out if you're interested in stalking us on other shows.
Right.
And, you know, speaking of other shows, we're going to get into our podcasting 101, I guess we're calling it.
All right, let's do it.
Well, it's a big show.
Two of the biggest questions we get, and even more so now that we're kind of the lame duck podcast, is is one, I'm thinking of starting a podcast. What would you recommend? You know, what should I do? Yeah. And then the second is, what other shows, if I like you, what other shows will I like? And we thought, especially with us kind of coming to an end, that this would be a good topic to tackle.
Yeah.
So I figure we can do it kind of in two parts there. The first being, I want to start a podcast. We're assuming a gaming podcast here, but it could be
anything.
Could
really
be any podcast. Yeah. I want to start a gaming podcast. I want to start a podcast. What do I do?
All right. And so one of the reasons why we wanted to kind of bring this up is that, you know, we got into podcasting because we just sort of wanted to add our voice to this mix of gaming podcasts, and we've had a great time doing it. But we definitely don't feel like we're the best podcast that's out there, of all podcasts of all time, sure. You know. And, you know, nor are we the worst, I don't think.
No.
But we also feel like there's greater work to be done, you know, that there's other folks out there. And, you know, we were just common gamers who decided we wanted to have a show. You know, any common gamers who are listening to this, you know, there's a possibility if you've got a propensity for it and the desire to do it and a little bit of time, you can make a podcast too. As I've heard it said many times, the best thing about podcasting is that anybody can do it. The worst thing about podcasting is that anybody can do it. Mm-hmm. And so you know, I guess it's good if you're are interested in starting a show that there's some guidelines that, you know, cautionary words that we could give on that. But I guess we should just start off by, you know, what was the reason why we got into podcasting in the first place? Yeah.
Boy, I forget. I mean, we were at Origins and we just thought we had some great gaming conversations, and, you know, especially like in the car ride, you know, a couple 3 hours ago to Columbus, you know, we thought what we talked about, we're like, well, someone would be interested. I think we talk about topics that are relevant to gamer culture and that are just kind of common gamery topics, and that sparked us. You know, there's not really that niche in gaming podcasts at the time. You know, there was, you know, you had the more professional look at it, you had the more like the NPR look at it, but you didn't have just like two schmucks from Indiana, not necessarily from Indiana, but, you know, just talking about common gamer stuff. And we felt like that's a niche we could fill.
Right. And, you know, so we stopped at, I think, a McDonald's on the way home from Columbus, mm-hmm. and we planned out our very first few segments that we're going to do. And I think more than some other podcasts that I've seen, we really did a lot of research up front. And I did a lot of like audio testing and equipment testing just to make sure that we hit the ground running and that our first episode was something that we could be proud of, that it wasn't just...
How long did you spend editing the first episode?
How long was the first episode? Probably about an hour and a half, something right. like that. I probably spent 4 or 5 hours editing that podcast. Now, to give you a little bit of contrast, you know, this episode that you're currently listening to, which I think will end up clocking in probably between an hour and a half, it will take me at most 2 hours to edit. And that includes all the musical interludes that you'll hear in the middle and all the little, Wayne voiceover spots and everything and all the fading in and fading out, that kind of stuff. I've gotten pretty fast at it just from doing it for so many years, but, I edited out every single that's in that show. If you go back to episode one, An Auspicious Beginning, you can hear, I mean, if you really crank up your volume, you can hear all of the different edits that are in it. I mean, I went crazy with it and that's a little bit overboard. Don't do that, you know, but, there are kind of two schools of thought, I think, when it comes to starting a new podcast, and I've heard both of them. I think both of them have some validity to them. One is that, and I believe this is true, that if you don't have content, don't make a podcast. Mm-hmm. If you don't really have anything to say, then, you know, don't buy a bunch of expensive equipment and just get on the mics and just, you know, try to come up with something.
Exactly. You know, and on the content, you know, you kind of got to have it doesn't have to be an overbearing one, but you kind of got to have a shtick.
Got to, yeah,
something. You know, it's like we're the Common Gamer Podcast. That's kind of our shtick. I wouldn't say we hammered into the ground, you know, we don't rail against the gaming elites or anything, but, you know, if you really like the Dice Tower, don't copy your show to be just like the Dice Tower, because the Dice Tower Prime is going to do it better. You know, you don't need to copy them. They're doing a fine job, you know, go a different direction. And, you know, it's just, I see a lot of those where they're just kind of second rate copies of the show they really like. And it's like, why bother even having it?
Right. You do have to have some distinction. And we've talked about that an awful lot. That's one of the great difficulties, I think, is how do you distinguish yourselves? And I think that really we have tried our best to distinguish ourselves. I think we have failed at that in some respects, and we've succeeded in some respects. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason that I even thought about podcasting in the first place was due to the Spiel podcast being right in our back door in Indianapolis, and that those guys were doing things with a high degree of quality. You know, that I sort of discovered their show, and they already had, I think at the time, 40 or 50 episodes under their belt, and every single one of them was just done with a great amount of quality. And I love the way the segments were put together. And as someone who's sort of a junior audio engineer, this amateur audio engineer, that was very interesting to me, the idea that, wow, I could get a piece of software and get a couple of microphones, and I could actually put together this seamless audio presentation, you know, that could sound somewhat professional, you know? So that was kind of a draw of it for me. So, you know, you'll notice on our show that I bought our microphones, and we're using the same microphones that we have since episode one. You know, I bought those and our pop filters and, you know, some of the different stuff that we did and the piece of software. I got all of that up front. You know, you'll hear some shows that say, well, we just grabbed a headset microphone off of an Xbox or something, and we just used that. And that's great because the whole point is you need to have content. If you don't have anything to say, it doesn't matter how good you sound saying nothing. But I'm a kind of a big believer that it drives me crazy when I listen to podcasts that have really poor audio quality where you sound like you're in a wind tunnel somewhere, mm-hmm. or that you've just, you know, picked up some kind of $5 microphone. So, you know, have some pride in what you're doing, you know, yeah. and invest maybe a little bit of money in some equipment.
Yeah. It's like, you don't have to really spend a ton of money, but, you know, I agree with John. It's kind of like, if you decide you want to do a podcast, it's almost kind of like, wait a week or take some time and wait, you right. know, and then do I want to do this? And, you know, maybe, oh, wait again. And then when you're finally, you're sure you want to do it. Yeah. Don't be afraid to put down. How much would you say at the time we started the show, the equipment we had to buy?
I would say that we probably, and I had the benefit of having access to a lot of the equipment at my church. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was able to test with some of those things.
So go to church.
No, you know, but, the initial investment was probably between $100 and $150.
Okay.
And that got, I was using a recorder that we plugged directly into that was actually like a compact flash recorder, that we don't use that anymore. But, the microphones were each about, I think they were about $50 a piece and, you know, a couple of mic stands and some pop filters. We actually, we have these pop filters, which kind of help with the P's and the B's, all that stuff. Which is, you know, it's kind of a screen that goes over our microphones, but I initially didn't want to spend the money on those. I think they were probably $20 or $30 a piece, but mm-hmm. So I found like a thing online where you could use an embroidery hoop and a pair of pantyhose to make
our first
pop filters. And I couldn't, they were easy to make and they sounded great and they worked just fine, but I couldn't figure out a way to attach them to the microphone stand. So literally probably for the first five or six or more episodes of the show, we held up these things in front of our face every time that we talked into the microphone.
There's got to be a picture.
There might
be a picture of that. Yeah,
but it was very different from the way it is now.
Yeah.
You know, I bought a couple of pairs of headphones that I still have the same headphones that we've used. They were like $20 a piece and, you know, you got to buy some cables and stuff. Since then we've moved on to recording into a, like a small digital recorder that uses an SD card, and we have a small soundboard. It's just a four channel, Behringer soundboard, analog soundboard that costs, I think I paid about $65-$70 for that. And so that's been really easy to kind of tote around. We put the entire podcasting rig will fit into my little blue duffel bag, mm-hmm. and we have that plus two mic stands, and we could pretty much record the show wherever we want to.
Yeah. And you know, we say all this because, you know, I think you could have the best content in the world and we I want to preface it again by saying we're not saying go out and break the bank. You have to spend $500 worth of equipment.
Boom. In fact, don't do that.
Don't do that at all, you know. But it's hard to take a show seriously if it sounds like crap. And you know, there are some shows, not even in the gaming realm, I would say outside of the gaming realm, people are like, you've got to listen to this podcast. And I listen to it, and it could have the greatest content, and it just, I can't get over how bad it sounds. Like I have to strain to listen, or it's too loud, or the levels are off. And I'm not an audio snob by any means. You know, John does all of the audio work. He can detect the little nuances more than I can. But you know, if something sounds like it's in a wind tunnel, like John's, it's like you have a hard time convincing me it's worth listening to. And even if you have the idea, well, we'll start really, really small. We'll start with, like, you know, just a headset and move on.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, you may not get me to come back because I remember how bad it sounded at the beginning. So,
Right. You know, and so if you don't want to invest a lot of money or even this small amount that I mentioned, you know, don't let that deter you. I mean, you can start with just a headset, microphone, everything. I think that the content will hopefully trump that, and you can at least get someone to come back. As far as the setup for how it's hosted and everything, we use a service called Liberated Syndication, or Libsyn. I think a lot of podcasts use that to create an RSS feed. So this is what we upload our files to, and then they create this RSS feed, which is what iTunes accesses and a lot of the other different aggregators will access. However you may happen to download this podcast, it's probably pulling from our RSS feed. That's of minimal expense. I think we pay about $12 a month to do that. that. Mm-hmm. And so that part of it is pretty easy. And, you know, if you don't have to be a computer genius to do it. I use a very basic piece of editing software called Cool Edit Pro. They don't even make it anymore. It's been upgraded by what's called Adobe Audition now. But you can also get a free audio editor called Audacity, which is, you know, I think used by a lot of pretty big-time gaming podcasts still. It's a full-featured audio thing. And I just taught myself how to use it. I'm not really a complete audio genius by any stretch of the imagination. I don't work in the industry or anything like that. And and a lot of you listeners would say, oh yeah, and it shows too.
Oh, hey.
Oh yeah. But you know, I just kind of taught myself how to do it. And I even have some of the rough cuts. You know, maybe on our last episode I can pull out some of those initial rough cuts of our first try.
Oh geez.
I still have them, yeah. just our first little tries at podcasting.
And if you're really cool and you have a Mac, then you can use GarageBand.
Use GarageBand, and that's real easy too. And you can even use that to make enhanced podcasts with pictures and things like that if you want to.
Yeah, we're good.
We tried that for one episode. I took one of the episodes that we had done, and I made a full-fledged enhanced thing. And we did a poll on our website, and everybody said, oh, we don't really care that much.
Yeah, I bet a few people do it, but nowadays, with so many people just listening at work or listening in the car,
yeah,
it's a good idea, but yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, we talked that's a little bit of the technical details and everything, you know, so you can teach yourself all this stuff. There's lots of resources online to be able to sort of teach you how to podcast. All you gotta do is Google, you know, how to make a podcast, and you can find so much information on it. But let's talk a little bit about content and presentation, you know, because that's, I think, in a gaming podcast going to be the most important part of it. So, you know, you kind of have to decide, I think, if you're going to do a show, what do you want your focus to be? Do you want it to be a news show that primarily talks about, you know, gaming news? Do you want to be mainly about reviews and doing game reviews? These days, it seems like the review part is almost becoming its own separate thing. You know, mm-hmm. Like, you don't see podcasts too much that are just reviews. You know, like our show, it's kind of a variety show. It contains a review along with some other discussion. But, you know, there's now podcast feeds that are just reviews. You know, Draken Strikes videos and Tom Vassell's stuff that he does. I think he has separate feeds just for review stuff for his videos. So you could do reviews if you wanted to, if that was something you were interested in.
You could do, you know, my favorite things are things along this vein, like, you know, just gamer culture type of things. You know, I find that interesting because just a lot of the why on gamers, like, why do we do that? You know?
Yeah. And I find that if you have a good conversation just sitting on the microphone, if someone's listening to that, they're going to feel like they're participating in it, you know, or they're sitting around listening to you talk while you're in the room there. And I found some of the best podcasts are ones where you have a group of friends sitting in a room with microphones, you know, talking about something, and you just feel like you're a part of that group, like, you know, like you're one of their friends, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is having that kind of casual friendliness in your presentation, I think, is really important. Now, at the same time, I think that one thing that Cody and I have seen a lot in podcasts of lots of different genres, and especially ones that don't tend to last for very long, is you have the problem of the people in the room basically making each other laugh. But, yeah, I mean, it's like there's a bunch of inside jokes going on, or there's a bunch of laughter going on, and, you know, cracking up, and it's like you don't feel like you're a part of that group. Mm-hmm. You know, you're listening to it going, what are they talking about? Or that wasn't really that funny. Why is that guy laughing so hard? You know? And I feel very removed from that. And I don't want to listen anymore.
Right.
And so we've tried real hard, not like it's intentional every time, but, you know, we want you guys to feel like, you know, you're just hanging around here at Cody's apartment with us, you know, just, you know, getting ready to play some games or talking about what we just played. And I, you know, outside of the podcast, away from the microphones, he and I give each other a hard time all the time. We have lots of inside jokes and things that we make fun of, and we laugh and all that kind of stuff. But we try to keep it to a minimum on the mic because we don't want you guys to feel excluded. You know, we don't want it to feel like, oh, what are those guys talking about? Why are they laughing? You know, and no one, future podcasters out there, it's no one wants to hear you laugh, really. No one, you know, they want you to say funny things, but no one wants to hear you laughing on the show. Would you agree with that?
I
think that's.
I about chuckled there, but then.
Yeah, then I would. Don't laugh. Don't
see,
you laugh.
See.
So, anyway, so those are just some tips, I guess. What would you say would be some other tips of like podcasts that you've listened to, that things that maybe that drive you nuts about podcasts, things that people can do, do well. I find sometimes chemistry and flow is a really big one.
Yeah, that's my biggest thing. I mean, just general likability. Like, I listened to Fear the Boot for many, many episodes, and just due to one of the hosts, and they have a ton of hosts. They bring in a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah.
And they do a good job with it, but there was just one guy I could not stand. And for that one guy, I just, I'm a curmudgeonly guy, and maybe you probably don't agree with me, and that'd be fine. But I hope I would never be so off-putting as that you would never want to listen to the show again.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there have just been some shows where one host or one contributor just irks you so much. It's like, I can't even put up with it to listen to the good parts. So right. I'd say, don't be a jerk. That's my best option there.
That's always good advice. I think all areas of life.
Thank you.
So yeah, I mean, I think when one other thing I just wanted to kind of talk about is sort of the difference between shows that are heavily scripted and then shows that are kind of more off the cuff. Because this is, a big decision you would need to make if you're gonna do a show, is do you want to have it scripted where you're reading the majority of what you're doing, or do you want it to have no script whatsoever where all you're doing is just kind of making it up off the top of your head?
Yeah, let me see. So you're going to have six phases in the action phase, and you can choose one of the... Oh, I went off script. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. Bad. Put it down. So these, there's positives and negatives to each of those things. Having it scripted means that it's going to sound exactly the way that you want it to, and that you have time to kind of rehearse it. This is a lot of times really good if you do a solo podcast, if you're going to do a review or some kind of a segment on someone else's show or something. I think it's helpful to have it written down and that you're reading it verbatim, and maybe you're reading it with some animation to it and some acting, if you will, to kind of liven things up. But that can be real beneficial. It's one of our favorite podcasts, the D6 Generation. I mean, the segments like Did You Ever Notice and Rapid Fire, those are pre-written by Craig Gallant, and he does a really great job of delivering those. And I think that if he had to pull those things off the top of his head, or if he was working off of some bullets, it wouldn't be quite as effective as if he's doing this kind of a recitation thing,
Now our show has been interesting because we started not scripted, but with heavy notes, lots of
bullet points, lots of notes.
And then it just kind of went down and down until I think the past 6 months we haven't used notes.
Right. And maybe that's, you're sitting where you are going,
it's obvious.
It's very obvious, but we just sort of found that, in general, we knew what we wanted to talk about, and that just playing off of one another was enough to bring up all the topics that we wanted to, And hopefully, when you hear our review of Eclipse here in a few minutes, that you'll be able to hear that we didn't write down a bunch of bullet points as to how we're going to review the game. But by the end of our conversation, you hopefully will have all the information that you need. And I think that's sort of the idea that we came up with all of our segments, is we have a topic and a really loose outline. And then we just sort of, then we just sit down and talk as friends. And hopefully that comes across well on the microphone.
Jerk.
Now, what about number of hosts?
I believe that's all to taste. I would say for me, a solo podcast, like a whole episode, that's hard for me to listen to.
Yeah.
It's just one guy. For contributors, that's, or smaller segments within one show, that's fine. I find that I think three is the magic number.
Yeah.
I think, and it's funny because there's two of us, but
if only we had a third, things would have gone better.
Two and three is my preference. I think certain shows can do it well with more, but you get to the point where everyone either has to have very distinctive voices or good discipline and not talking over each other, because if you get five or six people going, and you can't really follow what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that whenever you're listening to a show that's kind of a conversational show, I find that I'm always tending to relate to one of the hosts.
Right.
So if there's a multiple podcast host, like Fear the Boot's a good example, they usually have about four people, maybe more, for each of their episodes. As I find myself relating to one of those hosts, it might be changed from episode to episode, but this time I'm totally agreeing with what Wayne is saying, or I'm totally agreeing with what Dan is saying. And when there's only two of us, I'm sure that a lot of you hopefully have said that, well, my gaming tastes kind of line up with Cody, or kind of line up with John, or something like that. But I think it's even better when you have more people into the mix, because there's just a more divergence of personality, and just makes it more interesting.
Agreed.
Another thing that you have as an option to you, I guess, with the coolness of technology is that you don't actually have to be in the same room with the people that you're podcasting with. You know, Cody and I live 20 minutes apart, and so we're, you know, we always meet together to do our show. But, you know, with the advent of Skype and the heavily use of that, Skype is really great technology to be able to do podcasting across the way. I mean, across large distances. If you look at the Dice Tower is a great example of the two hosts for that, Tom Vassell and Eric Sommer. They, one lives in Florida, the other lives in Connecticut, you know, and they sound like they're in exactly the same room, you know, and there's some audio tricks you can do to make that sound even better. But even if you were just using recording directly off of Skype, it can sound pretty good. So, and that's free software, Skype, you know, to be able to do that. And it's not too hard to hook your soundboard into your computer to make that happen.
Yeah, so. I mean, there are some advantages to having everyone in the same room because we can play off of each other's cues and really, you know, just watch each other and kind of know how the show's going. So, but if you have good content, you have good hosts, then a remote show, obviously with, if you listen to any other show, you know, they do it successfully.
So. Right, right.
So a lot of people have been asking, you're going away. Who do I listen to now?
Okay. Well, go back and listen to all of our shows.
That's right.
Multiple times.
Twice. That's right.
And after you've done that and after you've had a good cry, there are several shows that we have listened to and that we've participated in certain cases that we really like. And Cody, give me your first one.
I will start with the more academic side. If you want to give your brain a workout, or I'd also call this the NPR division.
Uh-huh.
I would recommend The Spiel, based out of Indianapolis here.
Game and, of the World.
And Ludology by one Jeff Engelstein and Ryan Sturm. We were, like I mentioned earlier, we were guest hosts on there. They're very much the meta of podcasts, you know. Well, I don't really get so much into the what is a game. I don't like talking like that, but I do like when you know Jeff is discussing, you know, things like odds and things like certain game mechanics. I'm terrible at math. I wish I was good at it so I can kind of go vicariously through that. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end, The Spiel it seems like if NPR had a gaming show, it would be The Spiel. And I say that with all the best intentions. It's done in a style where it's very clean and kind of laid back and classy like that.
And I think there's probably no more professionally edited podcast out there than The Spiel, as far as different segments and you know, the musical interludes. And they always do an enhanced podcast with all the pictures in it. Stephen Conway and David Coulson, they put in a ton of work to put their show out. They always focus on they focus on new games sometimes, you know, and so they'll usually do a big review of a new game. They also have a section called Backshelf Spotlight, which they will highlight some older games. They have some other segments that are real fun. They have one called Truckloads of Goober, which is goober sort of their term for the chrome in a game, the cool bits and pieces and artwork and that kind of stuff. And
if I were to sum it up in a word, it would be awesome.
That's right. Dave Coulson likes that word a lot.
Now, if folks are looking for a show that you would say it's more similar in style to us, because we're not really in the intellectual NPR crowd.
No, not so much. No.
Who would you recommend?
I think the D6 Generation, who we've mentioned many times, is real similar to us as far as execution of sort of a conversational style. You know, they talk about the games that they've been playing. They do reviews. They do discussions. They do a good number of interviews, which we don't. We've done a few interviews on our show that hasn't been something we focus on very much. But they do quite a number of those. And you know, Craig Gallant and Russ Wakeland do a great job. And since the departure of their third host, Rafe Granger, they've brought in kind of a rotating third chair. So they have a different person every time. And you know, and Cody and I actually squeezed into that third chair for the most recent episode.
Very awkward.
It was very strange. But they do a great job. They do board games and role-playing games. They really delve quite a bit more into miniatures games, so things like Warhammer 40,000, all the Spartan Games lines like Dystopian Wars and Firestorm Armada, and a lot of those things. But they really get into sort of geek culture too. They're very entertaining, very funny, and a very long show, which they've gotten a lot of criticism, I think, for having such a long show. Their show, it comes out every 2 weeks. It's between 3.5 and 4 hours long. But I don't know. I don't know why more content is considered a downside thing, because I think they do a great job and they have, you know, long detailed segments and they definitely feel like you're sitting in a room with friends, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're fortunate to have made actual friends with them and have sat in rooms with them, so that's pretty cool. Of course, we can't really talk about gaming podcasts without talking about the Big Daddy,
mm-hmm.
and that is The Dice Tower.
Game On. The Dice Tower. That's right.
There you go.
And their empire.
That's right. They're taking over the gaming world.
I remember when we had that Origins board gaming panel, and this is the kind of thing you just told people not to do and talk about like personal stories and inside jokes. But
no, go ahead.
But I remember when
we're all friends here now.
Tom did not like the idea of the Pulp Gamer Media Network, which we're by name involved in.
Yes.
But and now the Dice Tower Network is taking over the world. I just find that funny. But they do some really good stuff over there, and we're very pleased to call Tom and Eric friends. They may not call us friends, but
I think they probably do.
Mortal enemies. Yeah. They produce really good stuff over there, and I think between them and the D6G, I think you'll start to get your fix there.
Exactly.
I would say don't leave us just yet. We got a few more episodes. And finally, we have not only do penance to Myriad Games, but Myriad Games Presentations, the podcast put out by the game store Myriad Games, is very good. They produce a lot of it's kind of nice because you can almost do that a la carte.
Uh-huh.
I thought I'd get more out of that.
No, it's fine.
They have Game Gab where they're talking about games. They have Session Impressions. They have all sorts of things where you can kind of pick and choose how you want. But they have a rotating crew of hosts to where, not every episode is the same. So,
and that's one thing that's, I think, different about their show than others that is very cool is that, our show, maybe you listen to it because you like us, or you like listening to the stuff that we talk about, no matter what we're saying, and it's not going to be a particular game that draws you into our show. Like, oh, they're reviewing Eclipse in this episode, so I definitely want to listen. You might listen anyway, cause that's the way I am with shows like the Dice Towers, whatever they're talking about, I'll listen to that show. Cause I like the personalities on there. While the Myriad Games presentation also has great personalities on it and great, great folks doing that, you might find yourself listening to that show for a specific game because they'll focus on a session impression for a particular game. And if you're doing research on a game, maybe you're going to go to Tom Vassell's video review, then maybe you're going to go and check out a Myriad Games presentation as well to get the most information. So I really like that it can be very targeted by game. Also, we just want to mention, though, that we are, a part of the Pulp Gamer Media Network, and that Pulp Gamer has a whole series of shows as well. They have a show called Out of Character, which that show has been based, has involved both board games and RPGs and lots of other kinds of games. And they're really going to more of a focus on role-playing games. So that's a good role-playing podcast. Also on the Pulp Gamer Network, Fear the Boot. Is a long-running, very
is Chad still
steadfast. I don't know. I don't know. But I actually haven't listened in a while. But they every week they crank out a show with topics on role-playing games. And so if RPGs are your thing, that's really an archetypal show. There's a lot of new ones that have come out, and we're kind of talking about some of the more established ones. But if you go to iTunes, if you go to other places where you're going to find podcasts, search for gaming podcasts and look in the other games section of iTunes. That's where you're going to find a lot of the ones for board games and tabletop games. But a lot of new ones coming out all the time, and hopefully the real good ones are going to stay, the cream's going to rise to the top, and the ones that aren't so good are going to pod fade. So encourage you to go and check out some other shows. When we have ridden off into the sunset, there's still a lot of great gaming podcast content to be had. So I hope this was at least somewhat informative to you. If you're not interested in making a show at all, you might have already fast forwarded through half of this, but we just wanted to kind of give you our perspective on podcasting, and we've had such a great time doing this.
And it also answers 3/4 of the emails sitting in the inbox.
That's
just
true.
One episode. Boom.
That's
done.
True. Maybe we could sell our microphone. We could autograph our microphones and sell them on I don't know where we would sell them, but $5 for an autographed microphone.
Here's your cat, and here's your $20.
Exactly. All right, so that is a little look at podcasting. You ready for our review?
Let's do it.
All right.
Once upon a time, there was light in my life. Now there's only love in the dark. Nothing I can say, total eclipse of the heart.
All right, it's time for Buy, Try, or Deny, where we're going to be taking a look at the new hotness. And we just want to start off and apologize a little bit for this review because we know that this is a game that is the super, super hotness right now on Board Game Geek.
People are selling their first and second born children in some instances to get a copy of it.
Yeah, but that it's not really available in wide distribution right now because it's out of print and we're waiting for the reprint, which I think is supposed to come in April or May.
I'm not waiting for it.
Cody's not, though, because thanks to our friends at Myriad Games, he was able to get hooked up with a copy of it. So look at it this way, that you can take this review and just have it be a good overview of how the game works and can add to your desire to buy it or your desire to not get it. So, and you know, and when that time comes to make your pre-order or whatever, then, you know, you'll be well informed.
Yeah.
So don't hate us, you know, don't hate us because we have the game.
Don't be a hater, yo.
Yeah.
As the kids say.
So we're going to be looking at Eclipse, which is from, boy, who's the publisher for this
guy? It is the,
it's
it
the
is,
box lid here.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I want to see you pronounce this. Go.
Ooh, fail. Lautapelit.fi.
Yeah, I believe it's a Finnish. I know it's a guy from Finland who did it. I think it was Finland. I think it's his first design, and this company is really like their first.
Not his first design, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, sorry, I didn't mean to shoot you down there. He's actually had several games, but this is the first one that's gotten any sort of, you know, big release before.
His first real game design.
Okay, the rest of them don't count.
That's right.
Yeah. But yeah, the designer's name, gonna screw it up. It's like Tuco Takokalio or something like that.
Right, so it's Eclipse, New Dawn for the Galaxy. It is a 4X space game about, you know, it's like any other 4X space game where it's all about building your space empire and building a fleet and researching technologies and all that good stuff that comes with a 4X space game. Now,
what are the 4Xs?
Oh, you would ask that. I believe I believe it's expand, exploit, exterminate,
explore. I think is the first one, right? Explore, expand, exploit, exterminate.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I think extreme.
None of those sections
exfoliate.
None of them start with an X, but you know.
There you go. So the idea, a lot of people have been comparing this to Twilight Imperium. I'll address that towards the end here.
Okay.
Because they're both games where the galaxy is set up with hexes and there are little plastic ships and you move them around and there's a big galactic center. So there's a lot to be gleaned there.
Mm-hmm.
I would say Eclipse plays about, with experienced players who know the rules, I would say 30 minutes a player. I would say for a learning game, more like 45 to 50 minutes a player.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about this is, like I said, 30 minutes a player, and that's not stretching it. I mean, it plays very quick, I would say. Well, I mean, once you get it down, it's not, I would say, a real difficult game. You kind of have to learn everything up front, but it's a set number of turns. It's 9 turns, and players really have one big decision to make each round. So.
Yeah, and that, you know, that's one of the nice things, and we'll talk about a little bit more when we get into the actual gameplay. Is that it's a game where there's a lot going on, but at any one given moment, you don't have a whole lot of things you have to keep track of.
Right.
You know, you have a few things, but your decision making is kind of limited, which is a good thing in this case.
Yes. Okay, so here is how I'm just going to go through the phases. We're not going to get real in-depth with this because even though it is, we would say, somewhat easy to pick up, there's still a lot going on.
Yeah, you want me to do setup real quick?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll just talk about this, the setup of the game, and then Cody's going to go through how a turn of the game works. But the idea is that every player will have their own hex, which represents sort of their little home base in the galaxy. And then there's going to be a home, what's it called? The central, is there a name for it? The central facility?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, there's like some center hex. It's like the center of the galaxy.
It's Mechatol Rex,
basically. Yeah, basically. And it has this big planetary defense system sort of token on it. So that if you did want to go in there, you're going to have to bring some firepower because there's a lot of defenses there. And so there's that hex that's in the middle. And then there's sort of a invisible ring of hexes that aren't there to start off with. You don't actually start off with the entire board on the table. You just start off with that center hex and then everybody's individual home base hex. And they're sort of spread out around the center hex. And then as you explore, you're going to be pulling hexes from these different piles and placing them adjacent to the hexes that you're exploring from, and you'll slowly be building the board. So the board at the end of a game is going to look different every single time, mm-hmm. just a bit based upon what you decide to do during the game. So you're just going to set up those home bases, and then everybody has a player board, and then there's a centralized board that has all of the other stuff that you'll be using during the game. So your player board is used to keep track of resources, to keep track of your technologies, also to keep track of your individual ships. In this game, as we'll talk about in a second, you can actually customize the different kinds of ships that you have by kind of tricking them out with a whole bunch of different things, weapons and defenses and rockets and that kind of stuff. So that's the third one for a la. Galaxy Trucker kind of a thing. You can build things onto your ships. And then the centralized board is going to have all of the different technologies that might come up during the game, all of the different ship parts that you can build. You'll have your turn tracker on there, and there's also just places to keep track of other little tokens during the game. So you're going to set up all that stuff, get your player board. You're basically dealing with three resources in this game, and they are basically by color. There's orange, pink, and brown. Mm-hmm. And you're going to start off with your board full of these cubes. And as you use them for different things, you're going to be pulling those off of your board. But anyway, you're going to start off with sort of setting all of those up and covering up all of your spaces and everything. And then you'll also have these discs you'll be using these influence discs to take your actions. So once you set up your player board, the centralized player board, and your kind of home bases, you're kind of ready to play. So, Cody.
All right. So from that, you'll go into the action phase, which is the real meat and potatoes of the game. The neat thing is that you can take as many actions as you want on your turn, but only one at a time. So, I would take a turn, and then John would take a turn, and the next player. And if it comes around to me, excuse me, I can either pass or I can take another turn. The mechanic used for this is pretty neat. John mentioned these discs. There is a track on the bottom of the player board. The more discs you use, the higher your upkeep cost at the end of your turn is going to be. Now, what that means is John mentioned the three kind of colors. There's like an orange, a pink, and a brown. Orange is your economy, pink is your science, and brown is your materials. So you almost don't want to overextend yourself because you can kind of see how much you're going to produce money-wise, and then you may be down on your track where it says, if I take another action, that's a minus 13 on my economics, so I got to be able to make sure I can cover that when it's time to settle up.
All right,
so here are the different kind of actions you can do. The first is explore. Now, like John mentioned, the game starts just with the center hex and then the player hexes, and everything else is not set yet. So with explore, you place a hex next to where you have a disc or a ship, and you decide whether you want to place it or not. How the game works is that each corner of the hex may or may not have half of what they call a wormhole. It looks like a little bullseye, like a little target logo. And if you connect it with another hex to basically complete the circles, then that makes a wormhole to where those hexes are adjacent. So just because two hexes may be physically adjacent, they may not be adjacent in terms of the game.
Space is big.
So that's how they write that off. And the way the game breaks it up is that there are three rings of hexes. There's the one ring, to rule them all, that is all of the things that are one hex away from the center, that are kind of like the galactic center. And beyond that is the two, and then anything that's three or more is in that kind of class three hex. Now, what's interesting about this game, like John said, the board will never be the same, because you can choose to explore outward. Like, you don't even have to go toward the center. You can go four, five, six, seven hexes away from the center, and you'll just be drawing threes. Now, the reason you may not want to do that is the juicier planets and things are usually closer to the center, the ones that have places where you can get more resources and place cubes and get things like that. So,
yeah, because on these planets, after you've explored and placed your hex, for one thing, in the very center of the hex, there's a space for a disc. And so if you decide that you want to explore that and kind of settle on that in that hex, you're going to place one of your influence discs on there. Now, you're already taking one of your discs, your action discs, and placing it onto the action itself, your explore action. And then you're going to take a second disc and place it onto the hex itself. So it's really costing two to be able to do that. Once you do that, then you have access to sort of place, sort of like almost like worker placement. You're going to place your cubes onto the hex in the various planets. And so there's going to be pink planets and brown planets and orange planets that you can place your... it's more or less just like putting guys on the planet there that are going to be harvesting resources for you. So there might be one for materials that's brown, and you'll pull one of your cubes off of your player board, put it onto that planet, then that's going to reveal a number on your player board. And that's just kind of indicating the number of resources that you're going to be getting from that cube being on the planet there. The more of those that you're able to take off of your player board, the higher the number is going to get, which will be the higher number of resources you'll get at the end of your turn when you do this sort of settling up and that kind of stuff. So you want to try to find the planets that have the most opportunities to place cubes on them that you can, because that'll just get you more stuff to buy more stuff.
Right. And normally there's a limit to how many cubes you can place. You have things called colony ships. You have three of them. Mm-hmm. And every time you place a cube, you have to flip over. You have to basically use one of the colony ships. The way you can get, and you can do that during any, that's not tied to a specific action, so you don't have to do it the same turn you explore, you just kind of do it when you really want to do it. The second action you can take is influence, and this isn't one that comes up a lot. It allows you to move influence discs around, and you get to refresh your colony ships. You might do this, sometimes you have the need to take back discs, kind of like unclaim planets, because you've stretched yourself too thin, and it's just, you're spending too much money. Or if an opponent leaves, you know, this happened in a game I was in where an opponent had a kind of a low value planet and just decided to take his disc back because he needed the space. And then on the last turn, because usually claiming planets gives you some form of victory points, I just claimed it because it was out there and I had an adjacent system. So I just took it.
Yep.
That's pretty much all influence is there. Next one is research. And this allows you to pay science, or pay the pink resource, to research technology. So a lot of this game and a lot of that kind of communal board is filled with different technologies, and those technologies will allow you to build different upgrades or do different things. So with the tech, there's a bag of all sorts of different technologies, and each turn, depending on the number of players, you're going to draw X amount and place them on the board. So all techs aren't always available. You kind of have to... you have to just pick from what's there. And there are three different kind of technology tracks. And as you buy more in a certain line, future techs in that line become cheaper. Like you know, there's not really, it's not so much a set tech tree. Like you have to have X to get Y, you have to have Y to get Z. It's not really like that at all. You can just get the most expensive tech right away if you want.
You just have to have the most, that amount of science to be able to
do
that.
And it's usually a lot. So the game almost kind of, kind of unwittingly do a tech tree. You start with cheaper resources, so you get better discounts down the line.
Yeah, and that's really cool the way that's put together to sort of naturally put you on that sort of progression and that path. And then on your player board, it's very easy to see when you place your little technology tokens down to see, you know, how much are certain things costing now and which things do you have available to you. And you know, one nice sort of random element in the game is the fact that you don't have every technology available to you, and that, you know, you may want a particular technology, but it may not ever come out in the game. You know, you can hope for it, mm-hmm. but sometimes you can't bank on it. And that's actually, getting the technologies is one of the ways things where player turn order and having the start player icon is going to be very important. We're going to talk about that in a second.
Right. So that's research. Then the thing that kind of goes hand in hand with research is upgrade. Upgrade is where you take some of the things that you've learned with your research and apply it to your ships. Now, with upgrade, those are specific to the ships. And like John mentioned, you kind of have a blueprint for each of your ships, from the little interceptor to the big dreadnoughts to star bases. And different technologies allow you to improve the hull, or you get a targeting computer, or you get
plasma cannons.
Yeah, you get shields, just all sorts of things to where you can build your ships the way you want to build them. If you just want to build a really heavily armored ship that doesn't have that much in guns, you can do that. If you want to build just a guns blazing sort of ship, you can work on that and do that. And so that's pretty neat, because combat, it's pretty much works with the base assumption that a 6 is a hit and does 1 damage, and a 1 is always a miss.
Yep.
And then everything you do, I mean, we don't even really have to get into combat that much, because everything you do just modifies that. It's like, you can change things from what is a hit, you know, is a 5 or a 6 a hit? Is a 4, 5, or 6 or a hit for one damage?
Right, and then certain guns, you start off rolling, I think it's yellow dice for the weakest guns, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, and color doesn't really matter so
well,
much.
No, I know, but you, if you have multiple ships with multiple kinds of guns, that'll keep them delineated. Right. But that's those different kinds of dice will indicate, maybe you roll that 6, but if it's a yellow die, it's going to count for one hit. But if it's an orange die, that 6 is going to count for 2 hits.
Right. Yeah. You can change what constitutes a success, how much damage a success does, things like that. So there's all sort, you know, how many hits a ship can take before it gets destroyed. Mm-hmm. All of that is handled through the technology research and then using the upgrade action to physically put the parts on your ships. And ships have X amount of room. They don't have unlimited things, so you have to make tough decisions. Do I want to give up my targeting computer for an extra point of hull? I don't know.
Right, and there's also I believe it's the energy or mm-hmm. a certain amount of energy that the ship has available to it to be able to put different parts on there. And so, if you know you really want super awesome guns, well, that's great, but those are going to require more energy, so you'll have to actually upgrade your energy generator or something like that.
Yeah, there's like a you know a. It starts out, maybe a ship can only produce 3 points of energy. So if you have more than 3 points of energy spread amongst your different parts of your ship, you can't use it. Later on, you can upgrade to a 6 or maybe a 9. And you can find through certain kind of like special events that come up. You know, this is part of the explore action. You'll sometimes find like you'll get a tile where you can take 2 victory points or you can take some sort of one-time benefit. And some of it is you find some alien tech that you can't get the technology for, you can never upgrade it, you have to find it. Like in our game, someone found a one tile that gave you 3 points of hull, which is a ton. You can't research that in the game.
Oh, cool.
And he put it on like an interceptor.
A little small ship.
So, yeah, so his interceptor was hard to kill.
And you know, like Cody said, as we're going around here, you take your turn and use your influence disc, and then it goes to the next player, and it comes back around to you. And you can do as many as you want, but you really are tempered by that number of discs, because the more you use, the more money you're going to have to spend, which is that orange cube, you know, in order to pay for all these things. So, you know, it's real tempting, I think, to, well, I want to upgrade this tech and this tech and this tech. Well, every time that you're wanting to upgrade a tech, you know, even if you have the technology for it, if you want to upgrade your ship a bunch of times, then you're having to use those discs. And so there's a great balancing mechanism in this game for, you know, you can't do too much because it's just going to cost you too much. And you can just see that very visually, that, you know, how that all works. So
yeah, a lot of fun. And as I go through these, just think, you know, you'll just be doing one of these. You're like saying, I am researching this turn. And then everyone else gets one action that comes back around and you decide what you want to do. And what's neat is, you know, there are technologies that give you extra discs. You know, if they come up, those are usually really popular because they're at such a premium during the game.
Yeah. So so you don't, like, you know, just to reiterate what he's saying there, you don't have to feel like you're burning your brain on all these different decisions. As a matter of fact, I found that like in a multiplayer game, you do your one thing, then it goes to the next player and the next player. And as long as you're not like involved in combat, if whatever it is they're doing, you probably don't care that much about, and you can be thinking about what you want to do next.
Right. All right. There's 2 more different actions you can take. One of them is build. And this is where you can build ships or structures. Kind of early on in the game, the only things you can build are the 3 types of ships, and they cost varying degrees of materials, which is the brown kind of resource we talked about. You can build a star base, which is more of a defensive thing. Later on, if you research the technology, you can buy orbitals, which are kind of little places in space where you can stick excess cubes, you know, because the whole idea is you want to get cubes off your board and get them onto planets or orbitals to generate more resources for you. Or you can build monoliths, which allow bones to be turned into spaceships if a monkey throws them. And it also gives you 3 victory points per monolith. So yeah. You're just buying victory points, which that's pretty nice. Again, that's another example of something you'd have to buy the technology for to even be able to build.
Right.
So normally with a build action, you can build up to 2 items. That could be 2 ships. It could be a ship and a structure. It could be 2 structures. Just 2 anything. All right? Mm-hmm. And then finally is the move action. You get to move ships, and you basically can do 3 move actions. Now, it's a little different from saying you can move each ship once, because by default, all of the ships have an engine that allows 1 move action equals 1 hex of movement. But like most everything else in this game, you can upgrade that to, now, 1 movement point for a ship allows them to move 2 hexes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only rule is that the move action allows you 3 move actions, or 3 kind of I don't know how you'd even points of movement.
Yeah.
I guess that's a good way to say it. But, you know, with later on advanced ships, one point of movement could equal three hexes worth of movement. So
those things are booking it. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are the six things you can do. And then whenever you decide you're done for the turn, either you've kind of you've spent all you want to spend or you decide you want to go first next round because the first player who passes goes first, that become the start player and they lead off the next round.
That can become very huge. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can decide to pass. And unlike other games, when you pass, you're still somewhat in the round. You can't take full actions, but there are three actions you could take at a diminished level. So it allows you, like, if you pass, this kind of happens in Twilight Imperium sometime, someone may wait for you to pass and then, you know, just send the house at you and mm-hmm. fully attack you. And it'll happen in this game, too, but you have a little more of a defense mechanism in this. Because after you pass, you can still do the following three actions. You can move, but instead of moving, getting three movement points, you only get one. And you still have to spend a full...
Still calling you cost disc, you a disc.
Yeah. Right. You can build, but you can only build one ship or structure. Or you can upgrade, but instead of getting two upgrades, you get one.
Mm-hmm.
So they're pretty much, it's like emergency power. You know, if you really have to do this emergency reaction, you do it, but it still costs the same as a movement. So you don't want to just pass and then spend them on these because you're not getting the most bang for your buck.
And one of the neatest things from, like, I guess it would be a graphic design standpoint is that... every player gets sort of a card that lists all the different actions you can do, just as Cody's described them here. It's like a little cardboard card. And once you pass, you will flip that card over. And on the back of that, it has not only the actions you can take when you pass, but that the back of that card is where you put those discs.
Mm-hmm.
It has the slots for the discs for those particular sort of reaction actions. And so I think that's really clever that, you know, when you pass, it's like you're physically going, I pass, and you flip that over. And so everyone else can see that you've passed, and now you have these other options available to you.
Yeah, and you know, John touched on the graphic design and iconography. I mean, that's the quickest way to my heart, and this game does it exceptionally well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everything, once you understand what an icon does, you can just look at it and immediately know what any tech does just by looking at it. You're like, oh, okay, that obviously gives me plus 2 points of movement. You know, it's very well done, so I applaud them for that. So that's the whole action phase. You'll do any of the actions you want as many times as you want. You can do a build action 3 times in a row if you want. You just have to spend a disc every time.
Mm-hmm.
After that, you move on to a combat phase. Basically, if anyone moved into someone else's space or moved into a space where there's kind of like a neutral alien and they want to blow up, and then you handle combat. I won't get into the particulars because, like I mentioned, it starts with the assumption that a 6 is a hit for 1 point of damage, a 1 is always a miss, and then everything else is just modifiers to that. You modify your ship to where the threshold for a hit is larger or the results of a hit are larger.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll compare them.
Multiple rounds of combat. And you basically continue to do rounds of combat until the battle's resolved and someone's completely destroyed or someone chooses to retreat.
Right. And I have to say, seeing battles in the beginning of a game when the ships are weak, and then later in the game when you have people who, if they get a success, they're doing 4 points of damage on one hit.
Yeah.
It scales so well. I mean. I hate to just keep bringing it up with TI3, but it's kind of like when you get large scale battles and that, those really drag just because they're bigger weapons, they're bigger ships, and it seems to take longer. It didn't seem to take much longer at all. It was still as fluid and as intuitive as the smaller battle was.
Yeah.
So that was pretty neat. After that, you're going to go to the upkeep phase, which is basically just bookkeeping. Any colony ships you have remaining, you can use. If there's any cubes you want to put down, this will be the last time you do it this turn. And then you basically just do the books. You start out with orange, which is your money, and it's more or less a net. You see on your board how many cubes you've gotten rid of. So let's say you had a 12 showing,
mm-hmm.
and based on the amount of actions you took, you are at a minus 13. You just take the net and you just decrease your money by one.
Right.
Yep.
And there's a track on the outside of the player board with little tokens for all three of these things. So this is where it's very similar to Through the Ages, is that you know there's tracks that keep track of all of these different resources so that you know how many that you have. So there's a little bit of bookkeeping when you're taking your actions to decide, well, how far into the hole can I go? You know, mm-hmm. because if you touch on maybe the trading.
Yeah. So what's neat about the player boards themselves is there's everyone has a human side, which is kind of the generic starting race and what they recommend you begin with. Then the other side is a specific alien race that has different powers and other things. And all of these races have a trade ratio where you can trade two of one resource for one of another. So you could trade two science for a money or two materials for a science or something like that.
Yeah.
Different alien races may have... That's kind of the Terran's great ability, is that, you know, they always trade it 2-1. Some aliens may trade it 3-1 or even 4-1, but they get some other power to make up for it. So if you find that, you know, when you've checked the net amount of your money that you're going to go bankrupt, you can choose to, if you've got a bunch of excess science, you could burn some science to help offset that cost. Otherwise, if you find you're in the hole, you have to start pulling influence discs and making yourself smaller kind of in the galaxy.
Less
which is
expensive.
Which is never good.
No.
So you get your net amount of money, and then based on how much pink and brown is showing in your on your track there, you basically get your science and you get your materials.
Yep.
And then the last thing you do is you take all of your discs back and put them on the track, and then you'll draw new technology and you'll see what's available to be bought this turn. And that really is it. Yeah. And you do that 9 times, and that's your game.
Now talk about victory points as far as combat, because that's one of the main ways that you get victory points, and we didn't really talk about that
yet. So the one thing in combat to talk about, like John mentioned, you can, in a battle, you can choose to, it's a lot like other 4X games, you can choose to fight, and then at a certain point you can choose to retreat. But in this game it's interesting because you may just want to stay in the fight just to gain glory. We call it, you know, the man option. And so what you're going to do is, at the end of a combat, you'll get to draw a certain amount of reputation tiles from a bag. And this is a bag full of tiles ranging from 1 to 4. There are more ones than there are fours. And you get a draw out of the bag. You get it for defeating certain ship types, for destroying, you know, bigger ships, you get more pulls. And even if you get completely decimated, as long as you didn't retreat and you stayed in the battle, you still get a pull from that. Just right. It's kind of your...
They'll still talk about you in the tavern, in the space tavern.
Exactly.
You know?
So depending, you know, if you get one pull or 5 pulls or anything in between, you'll pull that many tokens. You'll decide on one to keep, and you'll put it face down on your board. And then at the end of the game, that factors into victory points.
Right. And the cool thing about the tokens is that there's sort of a dual purpose to them, is that they can be used for victory points. Or there's also, is that right? I'm thinking of something different.
Yeah, you're thinking, I touched on that earlier, where you explore new hexes, and you can either take 2 victory points or the one-time benefit.
Yep, never mind, listeners, I was completely wrong.
All right, so once you get through the 9 rounds, you're probably wondering how you win. You win by getting the most victory points, or space awesome points.
Yes.
And you can get them through various things. You can get them through the reputation tiles. There are things called ambassador tiles in larger player games. You and other opponents can basically have a peace agreement on file, and you each get to trade a victory point to one another, as well as a worker. So you get to offload a cube onto someone else, and they get to offload a cube as well. But this is nice. It's more of a binding agreement, because if someone breaks it, they get branded a traitor, and there's a little
nasty card
token
that says minus.
And it's worth minus two victory points. So it's I think a little more flavorful than TI, where you have the trade agreements, but I don't think you lose that much by breaking it. You know, this is a solid 2 victory points that you'll lose.
They should have made like a hat or something, because it's like the stigma of you're the traitor, you know?
Yeah, a veil or something.
And that's until someone else does it, right?
Right.
They become the traitor. Yeah.
You get 1 to 4 victory points based on the hex you control. Like I said, the hexes that are farther out are worth fewer victory points. The center hex is worth 4 if you control it.
Yeah.
So that's pretty big. You can get victory points from the discovery tiles, or what they're called, to where, you know, you decide if you want the 2 victory points or the one-time benefit. The monoliths I mentioned earlier give you victory points. And then technology, the farther you get on a track, not only do you get discounted rates on further tech in that, you start earning victory points if you get into the second half of the track. And so the last game I played, I maxed out all 3 tracks.
Wow.
I had all tech, and I still lost, but I got 15 victory points alone from only technology, so that was pretty neat. And then you may have a species bonus, but then you total all that up, and whoever has the most VP wins the galaxy.
Nice. And so that is Eclipse.
That's in a nutshell.
So here at Game On with Cody and John, we use kind of a buy, try, or deny rating system where we give you buy points, things that we really liked about the game, try points, things that are kind of eh, and deny points, things that we don't like that we think are the kind of big red lights, I guess. And so to give you an overall picture of the game. So, Cody, let's talk about buy points for Eclipse.
Oh, where to start? It's one of those games where... I don't like to overuse buzzwords like elegant and things like that, but it's very elegant. It's everything. I think the last game I can really equate it to that I got this feeling of was Alien Frontiers.
Oh, yeah.
To where it's everything just makes sense. You know, it's like the icons make sense, the flow of the game makes sense, and it's a deep game without a huge learning curve. Like I said, there's just 9 turns. There's only really 6 actions you can take, but yet the game is really, really deep. You know, I equate it to Through the Ages and Twilight Imperium having a baby, because yeah. It really just seems like this mix of games that you would expect to be not very good, but it comes out being just a wonderful play experience. Yeah, another thing is the fact that you can play so differently each time. You can play really aggressive one game, or you can play very turtled and just... you know, just doing researching and things like that, and not really picking any fights. So it's very versatile, and it just works.
That is, I think, my favorite part about this game is just the fact that, you know, everything makes sense and everything is very intuitive, and you don't have to feel like there's some big abstraction between the theme and then, you know, the mechanics that you're doing. The theme is very, I think, well integrated into this game. You know, even though. It's almost, this game has more Euro to it, I think, than a lot of people would be willing to admit. I mean, there's a lot of resource management, worker placement, that kind of stuff. But it's so well veiled, I guess, with this great theme. And it makes so much sense with the theme that I think it just makes the gameplay, the picky details of the gameplay kind of fade into the background. You know, and that's great, because I think you can then immerse yourself in the story of the game and sort of what you're trying to explore in the game. And I just love that. I love games that make sense. It's really the reason why Through the Ages is currently my number one favorite game, is the fact that game, for being kind of dry Euro a little bit, you know, it just makes so much sense that nothing is ever in question about, you know, how it's supposed to work. And Eclipse is the same way. I got to give it real high points for graphic design and for iconography. It's one of the best, probably the best I've seen since Alien Frontiers, which was kind of my benchmark for great iconography in a game. So everything's real easy to understand because of that. Any other buy points?
No.
Okay. Try points?
My only real try point is that this game, once you and your buddies learn how to play it, you can knock it out in 2, maybe 2.5 hours tops. And I say that as a try point because that's really good for some and it's really bad for some. You know, I go back to my Twilight Imperium. You know, a lot of people want to say, oh, will this Jones theory out Twilight Imperium? I don't even think you can compare them that closely. I think that, yeah, they're both 4X games, and yeah, there's a lot of similarities, but I don't think they're designed to provide the same experience. You know, I almost feel like after 9 turns of Eclipse, you really feel like there could be a few more. You know, you just feel like things are getting started. And for some, it kind of ends too abruptly. Like if you don't get into the fighting until very late in the game, you know, 9 turns can seem too short. Whereas in TI, when you finish, you're never saying, man, I would, you know, that felt incomplete. That needed a few more turns. Like, no, because you've been playing for 8 hours.
I
don't say one beats the other. I think you're going to get Eclipse to the table a lot more. I mean, because really, if you know it, 2 hours is not a ridiculous amount. It really eclipses along. Eclipse along.
Nice.
Right, thank you. So I would just use that as a warning that if you're looking for the big epic TI type experience, you may not find it here, and that could be a very good or very bad thing. That's why it's a try point for me. You may just want to gauge your expectation. If you're looking for a TI killer, maybe this isn't it, but it is a similar experience on a smaller scale, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I think my try point is sort of a similar sort of thing, is that if you like being able to choose one of those 4 X's, you know, and just take that road to victory, you're not going to win probably. Right. And, you know, this game requires you to have a bit of a balanced look at how you do things. And I'm really thinking in comparison here to Sid Meier's Civilization, which is another 4X game, not in space, but that's a game where you have about four different ways that you can win. And even though you'd have to keep some balance and, you know, keep your defenses up and everything, if you decide that you want a cultural victory or a economic victory in Civilization, you just go hard after that, you know, and it's almost kind of a race of how quickly can you do that faster than someone else can do their victory condition. This game is very different from that in that, you know, you have to really expand. You have to do all four of those things. You know, you can't just say, I'm going to just get a whole lot of hexes and try to do that, you know, or I'm just going to try to just do combat, or I'm just going to do tech, because I think that you'll fall short. And, you know, if you don't try to have at least some balance in the game with that. So I like that part of the game. Like I like having to balance multiple things. But for some people that kind of drives them crazy of, you know, oh, I can't juggle this many balls in the air. And so that might seem a little bit, but you know, a little bit tricky. But, you know, don't let that, if you're scared off by that kind of a game, though, don't let it scare you off. Don't let a clip scare you off, because this, unlike something like Agricola, is not, it's not difficult to juggle those things.
Right.
Any deny points?
My only deny point, besides the fact that it's out of print and people are charging almost double what the game costs. Just wait, folks.
That's a temporary deny point.
I hate the ships. I hate the Galactic Emperor, Eminent Domain. I hate those ships.
Yeah.
I can't believe I'm saying this, being the Ameritrasher I am.
Uh-oh.
I kind of wish the ships were just kind of like varying degrees of like triangular little pieces of wood, because everything else is cubes and discs, and it works, and it's kind of elegant looking. And then you have these kind of two big ships, you know, like the ships, the plastic model ships are almost a little bit too big, I think, for the game. I would prefer them just to be like little triangle, medium triangle, big triangle.
Like treehouse pyramids?
No, but no, more like...
I thought you were trying to angle for that.
No, but you know, that's actually a really good idea.
Oh, gosh.
That's a very good idea.
That's a terrible idea. Forgot I said that.
Well, that's probably about the same size, really. But no, I'm thinking just like little kind of like wooden triangles that...
Oh, I see.
You know, like an eighth of an inch high. Just kind of small things. You know, I think that would work better, because the big ships almost look kind of out of place.
Yeah.
Like, they're these really modeled ships, and everything else is a very artistic, elegant, abstract look of things. And then you have these really detailed ships.
Yeah, it's almost like they spent all this nice money on artwork and on production on everything else, and, you know, someone ran into the room at this company and said, we can get ships, too.
Yeah.
Ships? You know? And, yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that seems like what happened. And I know a lot of people, including Russ from the D6G, are... basically making, you know, getting ships from other games and, you know, adding it to it. But I want to go the simpler route. I might do the Ice House Pyramid, but and just go for a more refined look for it. That'd be my only deny point. The ship's kind of out of place.
Yeah, I have no deny points. So overall thoughts, I think we think this is a complete home run. I hate to say it after I've only played it once, so I got to give it a few more plays before I give it a serious look. It's definitely one of the top probably three games of 2001 that I played.
Oh, and easily.
And it's one of the few that, you know, if Cody didn't own it, I would have found some way to buy it probably. Actually, I did have an opportunity to buy it, but I passed on it because Cody did have it. But this is going to be a top 11 game for me without a doubt. So
yeah.
It's a fantastic implementation.
Yeah, one of the best games I've played in a long time. When it comes out, definitely give it a try. And if it's up your alley, I think you'll find that you're going to buy it for a reasonable price.
All right. So that is Eclipse.
All right.
Check it out.
What do you say we close out the show?
I say, let's do it.
Well, you've listened to another podtastic episode of Game On with Cody and John.
Yes.
It eclipses all other shows we've ever done.
Keep it going. You're doing great.
You got to give me some space here.
Oh, my gosh. So this was the second of the final five. After this episode, we've got three more great episodes of Game On with Cody and John before we ride off into the gaming sunset. So join us in 2 weeks where we're going to be having... What are we doing?
We're going to have a grand old time.
It's going to be a grand old time. We'll be talking about more gaming stuff. We're going to just leave you in suspense for this let you know when we actually get to it. But we'll be doing a review of some sort. We'll be doing a topic. we'll be doing the rundown. All the great stuff that you've come to love on Game On with
Cody
John.
Or loathe. And as we mentioned in the beginning, Game On with Cody John is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. Go to myriadgames.com/vote and vote Myriad today.
Feel free to continue to communicate with us. I know we haven't really emphasized our communication.
We're not dead.
We're not dead. And we've really, I wanted to make sure we said this. We really have appreciated this pretty amazing outpouring of affection and great comments and just good thoughts on our guild on Board Game Geek, on emails that we've gotten. We've gotten some great voicemails as well. And we are just very humbled and very grateful for all the great comments that we've gotten. And we're so happy to, you know, that we've been a part of your gaming life and you know, your listening enjoyment there. So really appreciate that. So keep them coming, you know, makes us feel all warm and fuzzy. So you can check us out at the Game On Inbox.
At gameoninbox@gmail.com.
We have still got the Game On hotline going on at 4138 Game On.
Flo is still employed.
That's right. And check out our guild on Board Game Geek, which you can get to through our link on gameonpodcast.com. So, hey, have a great couple weeks of gaming, and till next time,
Game On.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 4138-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at gameonpodcast.com. Join our guild on boardgamegeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at gameonpodcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on pulpgamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Game On.
Is there a problem, sir?
No. I just thought that I might join you this evening. If there's room.
Of course. Have a seat.
Would you care to deal, sir?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Data.
Actually, I used to be quite a card player in my youth, you know. I should have done this a long time ago.
You are always welcome.
So, five card stud, nothing wild. And the sky's the limit.